Welcome to the Brett Boone Podcast. Explore the mind of MLB All-Star, Silver Slugger, and Gold Glove winner, Brett Boone, as he sits down with his friends from the world of professional sports. Now up to bat, Brett Boone.
Let's get to Brett Boone right now. He joins us on the River Islands guest line. Played for the Mariners, among many other teams. Brett Boone joining us. Brett, how you doing today?
I'm doing good. How are you guys doing?
Oh, we're doing pretty good right now. Yeah. It would be nice if our baseball team had a better record. And let's just get into it.
Can I ask you, Brett? I just want to get right into it. Right. A guy like Raffy Devers, he's been in the game a long time. And he's had a lot of productive seasons. He's just, the at-bat quality is just all over the place right now. And I have never seen a guy miss so many right down the pipe fastballs who is a good hitter, and he just hasn't shown it with the Giants. How patient should the fan base be with this man? And at some point, he's got to turn it around, right?
No, absolutely. And he's an elite talent when it comes to getting in the box. You know, I wouldn't put him in the Soto category, but he's elite. I mean, you know, you see guys, and it's been a crazy start to the season. I mean, I remember having our preseason, you know, interviews that I was doing, and I look at the landscape and I'm like, wow, was I wrong there? I'm watching a team in Texas that, you know, I was a hitting coach a year ago for, and I'm watching a Corey Seager, who's also an elite hitter. Like you said, with Devers, he's missing heaters, and I'm going, how is he missing those pitches? That's baseball. That's hitting. I've been in that box. It is tough. And at times you think, who am I swinging? But Devers comes over, you know, he had some baggage coming over here with the attitude he had in Boston. And it started, I won't play first base. Then he ends up getting traded to the San Francisco Giants. Tough yard to hit in as a left-handed hitter. Tough yard to hit in. But you're getting paid the money you're getting paid as players. There's no excuses to be made. When push comes to shove, you've got to be the cog in the wheel in that offense. That's why they brought you in, to be the man that they stick in the middle of that lineup, and they expect you to carry the mail. And when you're not going to carry the mail, you're going to hear about it. You know, I know all about that, and as a player, I had that perspective. Was they pay me a lot of money to hit in the middle of a lineup and produce. And when I'm not producing, I'm going to hear it. And you know what? I deserve to hear it. Because on the flip side of that coin, when I am getting it done, when I'm hitting 3-run homers, when we're winning every night, I'm going to get the praise. And that's kind of what you sign up for. And it's a big boy game. And when you're not getting it done, you got to wear it. Right now, Rafael Devers is not doing what the Giants need him to do. I look at the whole lineup. I look at an Arise. He's doing what you expect him to do.
He's been great.
Hitting over he's hitting over 300. Great. He brings a great kind of vibe. He's an upbeat, let's go, Adames. He's got to do a lot better than this. I think he's 0 for 20, his last 24. Chapman is expected to be a cog in the wheel. And you're getting it from a Lee, from a Schmidt, guys that you don't expect to be the headliners when it comes to that Giants offense, coupled with the fact that you're playing in a tough division. You know, I don't care what you say. The Yankees are playing great right now. I had the Seattle Mariners to be one of the best teams in baseball. They're off to a rough start. A lot of teams that I expected to be a lot better off to real rough starts. But that Dodger team, I'll take the field when it comes to who's going to win the World Series. But if I have to pick a team, they're still the best. I think San Diego's playing a lot better than I expected them to be. I expected them to be a postseason team, but they've exceeded my expectations. Still have an elite bullpen down there in San Diego, and Arizona's good. So you're coupled with the fact that you're off to a rough start, you're in a real tough division.
Brad, again, staying on Raffy Devers here again, it's off to a slow start and it's early, but it's not going to be early for much longer. The swings and misses are ugly. The batted ball data is ugly. The bat speed's gone down. What is kind of the adjustment that maybe he can make right now? I mean, he's got the very exaggerated open stance. Is that something he's to look into changing, or is there really no adjustment he can make? It's just a matter of he's just kind of got to figure out a way to get himself into a groove. Like, what is the solution for him to kind of pull himself out of this funk?
Like every great hitter, you know, he's got to find a way. There's no magic, there's no magic way to get out of a slump. It's trial and error. It's tinkering. It's in that cage. It's behind the scenes, trying a little of this, little of that, little of this. The open stance, I fiddled with it in my career. You know, I was slightly open. I was a little bit more open. I think in today's game, especially being a left-handed hitter, when the majority of the pitchers you face are right-handed, having that open swing and having both eyes on that pitcher definitely is an advantage. And I think you see that in today's game, is everybody at worst is square, with the exception of a Giancarlo Stanton, but usually have a slightly open stance. I think that's how he feels comfortable. I don't think that has anything to do with it. There's so many things you can point to when hitters are struggling. Is their head moving? And the slightest of little idiosyncrasies change the complete dynamic that you can't always see just with a naked eye. But Rafael, he's been there. He's done that. He's put up the numbers in the past. He's a great hitter that isn't hitting great right now, and he's got to find a way. Nobody else can do it except for him. And it's the trial and error. It's working on things behind the scenes. Okay, this isn't working. Let's try this. All right, back to the drawing board. And it's a daily drill that you have to do to find it. At the end of the day, you just got to find a way to compete at 7 o'clock every night. It's not about the swing a lot of the time. It's about getting in a mind frame, knowing what swing I have today. Is it my A swing where I can back leg you? Or, oh, nope, today I got to go with swing B to compete and help my team win a game. And some days when you're feeling terrible coming to the ballpark, it's, all right, how do I survive today? And that's what all of us have to do. Just so happens when you're Rafael Devers, you're making a ton of money and you're expected to be the guy on the front of the media guide. There's a little more pressure on you.
You know, we got a big start today for Logan Webb, and his track record has been comprehensive. He's been a stud for quite some time. At the end of last year, you know, after the All-Star break, teams were hitting 285 against him. This year, they're hitting 262. He's been getting touched up a little. It just hasn't been as crisp. It hasn't been as sharp. What do you look for in guys that have thrown as many innings as he has to know that they still got that same stuff? Because we've got fans losing their minds over his raw, you know, spin rates and the velocity and the ABS system playing games on him. And I just think he's hit a rough patch here, but I am a little worried. So, you know, you've been in the dugout. Like, how are you guys viewing that when you're part of that coaching staff with someone like Logan Webb?
Well, that's what's so tough about today. Logan Webb, you're right. And I think stud is the word. I've watched him for years, and just his dash, when the ball comes out of his hand, how much it moves, that's always a positive for anybody. And that's not something you manufacture. That's just a God-given thing. In today's game, when you are so broken down to spin rate and this and that, and you got the average guy that's never been on a field in his life that can go to the data and say, your spin rate's this and that, it would drive me crazy. Once again, that's what you got to deal with if you sign up for this job, is you're going to be critiqued by guys that have never been within 100 yards of the batter's box, that are experts because they've got all the data and they're going to give it to you. It's part of it's one of the you got a lot of perks being in that position. But this is the flip side of the coin, is you're going to be critiqued by a lot. Let's be honest, a lot of guys that really don't have the credentials to critique you. That being said, they're fans, and that's the reason we play, and that's the reason we make a ton of money. So that comes with it. I think the Christmas, and it always comes down to this from a hitter. You keep the ball in the middle of the plate as a hitter, I'm going to get you. You keep the ball on the edges, and especially with his elite stuff, you're going to be successful, you know. And I hate to use examples from other teams because I watch the Texas Rangers quite a bit. I have an eye on them. I watch a Nathan Eovaldi from a year ago, who was, before he got hurt at the end of the season for us, was my Cy Young candidate. He was the guy. But all of a sudden, this year to start the season, I see it in his face. I see it in a start. Eovaldi's pitching today too, as with Webb. And you call this a big start? It's a big start for him. He's all over the map. He's got that stuff, but I can just see he's not, his mechanics aren't quite right. He's not able to put the ball exactly where he's used to putting it. And it all comes down to location. In a day and an age where we put so much emphasis on velocity and the radar gun and exit velocity, the great pitchers still live on the edges. They keep it out of the middle of the plate. You watch SportsCenter. Well, SportsCenter, I'm kind of dating myself here. But if you watch who hit home runs today, Every home run's in the middle of the plate. It's a mistake. Once in a while, a hitter, you take a great pitch down and in on the edge, and you hit it out. And as a hitter, I go, wow, what a swing. But usually all the damage is done in the middle of the plate. And I think with Webb right now, that's what he's doing. He's a little bit more in the middle of the plate with the stuff. Still got elite stuff. But when you stay and you're not on the edges and you're in the middle of the plate, you're going to get hurt by big league hitters.
You know, you've watched now almost a full month of the ABS. And again, that was part of the conversation for Logan Webb. Hey, a guy that lives on the edges, you know, has the strike zone been affected regarding the ABS and tightening and whatnot? I find the ABS to be kind of interesting. I didn't know what to expect, quite frankly, when you use it. You know, what count you use it in, how early in the game you use it, trying to steal a strike, maybe slow the pace of the game down at the end of a game if you have a couple of challenges left in your back pocket. Your overall opinion on maybe who might have the edge right now, pitchers or hitters, in this ABS kind of one-month trial we're in.
Well, I think, you know, when the ABS was, I welcome the ABS at this point with the technology we have and the critique that you just nonstop hear it from the announcers to, oh, that was a strike. To have this ABS system, I think is great. I think the fans love it. I think it's entertaining. I think it's that 5 second when the music, the do, 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 do music comes on. And then, you know, you hear a roar either way. Once again, huge entertainment value. And I think it's great. I think it's also shined a light on how good these umpires actually are to call with the velocity and the spin rate. You know, I'm kind of coming into the modern era spin rate that we have today. It's not easy being back there when you're that critiqued on the edges by a computer. I think it's showing how good these umpires really are and how much they get it right more often than not. I think the advantage is with the catchers as actually seeing it. But I was interested to see how, from a strategic standpoint, I had this conversation with my brother on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. I said, what is your strategy in the dugout? When do you use it? Because as a hitter, I know we get emotional and we might have not got a hit in the last 6 or 7 at bats. And it was a close one. And no, I can't go down on strikes again. And I tap my head when really that was emotion getting caught up in, oh, I can't do this again. When really it was a strike. So I think it's going to be something that plays out as it goes on. I think these players are going to get used to it and have a little more wits about them, when to use it, when not to. But it's tough to tell a guy that's struggling with all those emotions going through his head that, hey, it's the second inning, there's 2 outs and nobody's on base. Probably not a time to use it unless you're 100% sure, versus 7th inning, something that changes a 2-1 count or a 1-2 count into a 2-1 count with a runner on third and less than 2 outs. So easier said than done. I think the players, this is new for all of them, so they're kind of feeling their way. And, you know, I also think about the emotional part of the ABS. It's like, what if you get the called third strike as a pitcher? You're struggling on the mound. You're getting out of a big situation. You strike three. Wait a minute. It's being challenged. Oh, nope, it was ball. It's a ball four. How does that change your psyche? As a hitter, how does that change your psyche when you think you just walked in the tying run and all of a sudden, no, it was strike two and now you got to get back in battle? You went from what a great at bat to lay off that pitch to, oh, no, it was a strike and I got to battle again. So I don't think we're calculating that in as much the emotional side of this ABS. And it adds a really kind of cool nuance to it. Like I said, once again, more entertainment value. But I think it's something that'll weed its way out. And guys, you know, as the season goes on, they're going to get a little more aware. And, okay, I'm learning from my mistakes when I challenge. Now I'm not going to challenge so much. Interesting dynamic. And I think, once again, great for the game of baseball. I think in a couple of years, we're going to be beyond this ABS and it's just going to be strictly a robot umpire, which I think at this stage, as old school as I am, I think you have to have it with the modern day technology. You have to have it now, at least as a hitter, as a pitcher. I don't worry about who the umpire is today. I don't worry about it anymore because I know exactly from a scientific measure what a strike is and what a ball is. So there's no more arguing. It is what it is. And it's not the umpire having a bad day behind the plate or an umpire having a good day behind the plate. They've thrown caution to the way it's not a matter of opinion anymore. And I think it's time, the way our society is progressing, I think it's time for this. And actually, I welcome it.
So not to get too in the weeds on this one, but one of my only, like, it's not a gripe. It's more of a question. And you play the game. Some guys are more upright. You know, they might be 6'6", but they crouch real low. And so we're doing these static measurements on all of these guys, and that creates the batter strike zone. But I think of a guy like Mark McGwire, who was a taller individual, but he got down real tight and low in his stance. And so is that what a strike zone is, based off his stance, or is it based off his static measurement of how tall he is? Do you get what I'm saying there, Mooney?
Yeah, I completely get it, because for me, I was very, you know, because I'm not the tallest guy out there, so I had to create height. So I stood very narrow to get as high as I could get to gain the leverage that I naturally have, you know, I don't have being 5'10". Now, with two strikes, I get in a completely different stance. And now I'm a foot lower.
Exactly.
Now, does the technology have the ability to know mid at bat?
Can
that computer measure me and adjust the strike zone accordingly? It has to be able to do that if this is going to be a foolproof way of going forward. You have to be able to know Altuve at every stance he jumps in.
Exactly.
Okay, the computer's got it. But also Aaron Judge is coming up next, and I have to have the same advancements, the same computer technology to be able to advance that too. So as long as you can tell me for sure they have it, and you know who's going to know right away is the pitchers and the hitters. They're going to come back and go, they're not measuring when I make an adjustment in my two strike stance. But I think technology, as far as it's come, I think they're going to be able to
get
that right. There's always going to be kinks in the armor, but I think they're going to get it right. I don't think they're going to roll it out fully until they're really confident that we got this.
We got Brett Boone here joining us on the River Islands guest line, play for the Mariners, Reds, Braves, Padres, and Twins. Also hear him on the Brett Boone podcast and Odyssey podcast. Boone, you mentioned Willy Adames a minute ago. He's 0 for his last 24, and The at-bats from him that vex me the most are when pitchers just go that low and away slider or sweeper that he always loves to chase after. From a guy who stood in the batter's box a lot, what makes those pitches kind of so tantalizing to chase after? And what can you kind of do to kind of train yourself as a hitter to not chase after those low and away pitches?
Well, I don't think it's anything that's going to be foolproof. It's nothing that, I'm just going to stop chasing those pitches. We don't chase those pitches because we want to chase those pitches. We chase those pitches because we are deceived. And the pet peeve I have in listening to somebody try to break down somebody and if they're struggling, what do you hear all the time? Oh, he's trying to pull it. Well, what does that mean? Well, it's a good way of getting out of this little soundbite, and it makes me sound like I know what I'm talking about. That's the opposite of what any hitter is thinking. Oh, I'm trying to pull it. No, what it is out of hand, he recognizes that as being a fastball, and all of a sudden he's not seeing the spin. So it's, I'm out, I'm gone, and it looks like I'm just flailing at it. Not because I want to flail at it, because I didn't recognize the spin. And that's what hitting is recognizing the pitch out of the hand. You see guys that are locked in, and when they're hot, man, they're spitting on that slider off the plate by 2 inches like they saw it a week ago, and the rest of us just caught up with them. And then you see guys that are swinging at it when it's 10 feet from the strike zone. Because why? Because they were completely fooled out of the hand. And the great pitchers create those tunnels. They throw that fastball away, but they also throw that slider away that looks to be a fastball and break it off the outside corner. That's all about recognizing pitches early, getting your body into good position to see it. And when you'll notice when he starts going well, and he will, He's gonna completely ignore that pitch. But that's the art of hitting, and that's why it's so tough, so frustrating, and that's why guys like me love being miserable for a long time.
Booney, what was the longest 0-for streak you had? If you don't mind me asking.
I don't know. I think if you check my bubblegum card in the 96-97 era, I think I had quite a few 0-fers, and I remember those years. I hit 230 or 220 something. And I just, it felt like I got one hit a month, and it was just so trying. And that's what's so great about this game and so miserable about it. You go through those trials and error, you get your butt kicked. You talk about humble pie. And then to come out on the other end, put the work in and come back and have a great season the next year. That's what makes this game so complex, so hard, but so rewarding, because you know, hey, I was down at the bottom and now I'm at the top, and you appreciate the good times, but you learn from really that tough love and that humble pie.
It's a game of failure. That's what my dad used to always say. The greatest player of all time. This is his saying. You know, Willie Mays, he was out 7 out of 10 times. That's Hall of Fame, greatest player ever. So you think you should be batting 600? Like, get out of here, you know? And I think it's really hard
go ahead.
No, I was just saying, it's really hard for young players to deal with failure and minimal success.
Well, I think that's what makes a big leaguer a big leaguer. And a guy that plays 10 plus years, that's what makes him. Because everybody can't do it. I played against a lot of minor league guys with a ton of talent. You know, a ton of God-given ability. And then you wake up 5 years later and you go, what happened to that guy that I played against in Tacoma? He was unbelievable. Well, when they stack the decks, that's what they call it. In the big leagues, in the minor leagues, you play in, you know, usually one-story stadiums. All of a sudden, you go to Dodger Stadium, there's 5 decks up there. And it's a different world. It's like playing the local pub and then going to Carnegie Hall. There's a little bit difference, you know. And some guys are meant to be there and some guys aren't. And that's what a tenured, veteran, proven hitter, he's able to separate that. He's able to slow his breathing down when it gets into that big moment and become his arena. And some guys just can't do it. And you don't look at... If it weren't that hard, everybody'd be a big leaguer. Yeah. But it has a way of weeding its way out, and it's no different than any other occupation. The cream always rises to the top, and the best of the best, not just from a physical standpoint, but from a mental standpoint. That's what separates, and it still is. It's still, we talk about speed, strength, bat speed, all you want to talk about. What separates the great one is what's between their ears. It's still our most powerful weapon, the mind, and how we can slow our body, slow our heart rate. You hear that all the time when you're in the box, when it's a big situation. You learn as you go on in this game. I used to come to the plate with the bases loaded as a young player, and man, I'm gritting my teeth, and I'm going to hit a homer. As time went on, now that veteran pitcher is going to play on my aggressiveness. As time went on and I became a veteran, I thought, no, the pressure's on the pitcher. The bases are loaded. He's got to come to me. And I learned how to do that. But that just that comes with just strictly experience.
So I have a kind of offbeat Major League Baseball question about the American baseball player. There's a lot made about perfect game and all the tournaments and the amount of innings. And we could go hours, you know, just discussing how baseball is played at the youth level. But you've seen it. These hype fire bats. I mean, every dugout in every little league and every pony league all throughout the country's got $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 worth of bats, and we'll get 2 or 3 hits. You know what I mean? It's absurd. And then we played over the weekend in kind of like a wooden bat tournament. And I said, man, there's an art to pitching to a wooden bat. There's an art to squaring a wooden bat up that I think is kind of a lost art. And I just wonder, As Americans, I look at the American game and the young players. I just wonder how the game would be different in terms of development for both pitchers and hitters if we did away with the aluminum bats, knowing it probably will never go away. Do you think America is a little behind because of not adopting the wooden bats just in general?
You know, I came up in a generation where it was all aluminum. You know, if you go to my dad's generation, he was in Little League and all they used was wood bats. Now, with the amount of people playing the game of baseball around, I don't know if there's enough wood to accommodate every 6-year-old through 16-year-old with a dozen wood bats every year. I think it's already economically challenging anyway, with, like you said, how expensive these bats are, to all of a sudden have to give every little Johnny and Joey 12 Marucci's, you know, we're whacking them at $200 a bat. I don't think that's really economically feasible. I don't know how much they're, when you're a kid, you're growing up, you need a lighter bat. You need something to feel good. Let's be honest. As much as everybody likes it, and it's such a business now, as everybody likes to think, oh, my 7-year-old, he's the next Aaron Judge. Let's be honest. He's not. And he's never going to be. I coach, when I first retired, I coached all these my son's teams, and I loved it. And what a great time I had. And there were really good players, but there were really crazy parents. And I just have to sit them aside sometimes and go, here's the deal. Your son's not a big leaguer, but he's a really good player. Let him be a kid. Let him win this tournament. Let him get the big hit. Let him go have a slushy and a pretzel with his friends and go do what teenagers do or young kids do. Now, eventually, when you get into your high school years and you start to develop, there's going to be some guys that really stand out, and they're going to have a chance. Now it's time to get serious. But when you're a kid and all this pressure and all these youth travel balls and these showcases, I don't think we're going in a good direction. I think we're doing it for economic gain. And I just think, it was just so much simpler. I think kids shouldn't play year-round baseball. You don't have to just go with one sport because you're going to play it for a living. The odds say you have no chance of making a living at this. I'm not saying don't chase your dreams. Absolutely chase your dreams. Somebody's got to make it. But be a kid. Be a young man. Have a great childhood. Don't wake up when you're 25 and go, you know what? I hated my childhood because there was so much pressure and dad wanted me to be this player and that player and play on four different teams. I wanted to play football, but no, I was better at baseball. Play football. Football makes you a better baseball player. It teaches you less. Play basketball. Basketball makes you a better football player. Find out what your passion is. First of all, you got to be passionate if you want to be successful at the highest level, because if you're not passionate, you're going to get run over by the competition. I just wish we could go back to a little simpler way. And it even transfers to pro ball players today. I think what they're missing out with the way they're brought up, and it's not their fault, it's the culture, it's the way it is everything's a showcase. Mm. Everything is showing you my skills. It's not about winning and competing and beating his, beat his butt.
There you go.
I'm out there to kick your ass every time I take the field. But not in a crazy way. It's mm-hmm. It's like, no, I taught my kids, no, losing's not okay. We're here to step on their neck and beat them into oblivion. But when the game's over, we could smile and give hugs and say, hey, that was a good game. Hey, we lost, but we learned from losing as well. I think too much emphasis is putting on, oh, we got to showcase and we got to show our, you know, at this academy or this. It's all nonsense. You got to find out how to compete at 7 o'clock yes. every night. I did it a year ago. I talk to my hitters in Texas and I go, you're chasing the perfect swing. There is no perfect swing. You got to find out how to compete tonight. What do I have in the tank tonight? Who am I facing? What is my game plan to find a way to get a couple hits and to help my team win? Because that's what's important. Chasing the perfect swing is it doesn't exist. And sometimes I think this younger generation just comes up in this. With they're told how they have to perform and they get away from finding out how to win, finding out how to deal with losing, which is huge, but just competing every day. That's what we do. We come to the park, baseball, 162 games. There's nowhere to hide. It's not like the other sports, you know, football, you play once a week. I'm not taking anything away from that. It's a completely different sport and you have to train that way. For baseball, we play every day. 162, we get into a small car wreck, fender bender every night. How am I going to survive to tomorrow? And not to date myself, but if I've got Roger Clemens, Pedro Martinez, Glavin Smoltz, and Maddox coming up in the next 2 weeks, that's a nightmare. I've got to find a way to survive to fight another day. Because then I'm going to get a stretch where I'm going to get a bunch of five guys in the rotation, and I'm gonna live on that. I'm gonna feast. But I gotta find a way to frickin' survive in the meantime. And I don't think that's taught to our young players well in this day and age. And I think it's detrimental. The physical and the preparation and the athlete they're putting out at every sport, I think is improving. I think you'd be crazy to say it's not. But how we prepare and how we go to battle every day, I think it's taken a step back, and I think we have to change that.
Brad, great call. Brad, I feel like we could talk ball with you all day long.
I love you, Boone.
We're up against it here. Brett Boone, you recently had Steve Young on your podcast, so we'll definitely try and get people to go and take Steve's a look at best. That. The Brett Poon podcast.
He was great.
Yeah. Awesome.
Did you get a word in with him? Because the two of you can talk.
I'll tell you, Steve Young. Okay, I'm not a fan, and all my friends, everybody will tell you, I'm not a fan of anybody, anything. I was forced to be a fan of my dad because I wanted to go to the Veteran Stadium and hang out and shag when I was a kid. So I told my dad I was a fan of his. But I'm really not a fan of any players or any teams. But when I was a kid, I grew up in New Jersey. The 76ers of the 80s with Mo Cheeks and Daryl Dawkins and Julius Erving. And that was my team. I love that. And I loved the 49ers of the 90s with Steve Young at the helm. The lefty.
Beautiful.
Two things I'm fans of, and I told him that when he came on the show. I said, Steve, because we've been talking for a couple of years. I'm like, finally, you came on. I said, I'm not a fan of anybody, but I was a fan of those Niners of the 90s, that West Coast offense, and particularly Steve Young. It's very rare I get somebody on that I'm a fan or in awe of, but I love Steve Young, and he did not disappoint. The conversation was awesome. And it was funny because he said to me, he said, with this game today and how open it is and they can't lead with the head, it makes it so much easier for a quarterback. And he's like, he was getting passionate about it. He said, if I could play today, I'd be really good and stuff like he didn't disappoint. He was great. The podcast is out today. So I appreciate you bringing that up.
Thanks, Booney. We love you, buddy.
Appreciate your time, Booney. That was
see you soon.
That was